Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mean Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-host,
Jessica.
And yes, I do, but not on video.
Yes.
You need to be exposed to my amount of derping sometimes.
Mackie does it, but not on video.
She composite boat
like most of the world. Come on.
And yes, most of the world does play Civ. Thank you for acknowledging that, Mackie.
Yep.
I'm Chazzy Cat. I am the new guest. First time doing this. So welcome, everyone, to episode 195. With me is, as usual, Dan Q.
Technical difficulties suck.
We have Makalua.
I'm still asleep.
I hear you on that one. The Mean Team.
I'm not a gateway drug. I am rock bottom.
And imagine.
Wake me up when we're done.
Oh, man.
You know other things that suck? Time changes. Those suck.
Oh, yes. I'll get you.
That was last weekend.
Who said I was caught up?
So you've been an hour off all week?
My body has.
Oh, man.
On the next episode of Polycast, Madjin learns empathy.
What?
I don't think there's any empathy with him before coffee.
You're being silly.
I'm halfway done the first one. Does that count?
Imagine he wasn't protesting because he was asserting he had empathy, but rather that he would ever bother to learn it.
What?
What?
On the next episode of Polycast, we attempt to teach Madjin empathy.
What? Oh, okay. That's,
Civilization V, specifically Brave New World, the Moroccan civilization referred to as the Gateway to Africa. Ooh. One of the more recent strategy guides for Civ 5, brought to us by Mega Bears Fan, who's been a guest on a couple of episodes of Polycast in the past, said on the last episode, in fact, that we would pair Morocco with the next civilization, which happens to be Portugal. Portugal is briefly mentioned in the Moroccan strategy. So this was all part of the master plan here on Polycast.
Mm-hmm.
So let's start off. The unique ability is, in fact, Gateway to Africa, receiving +3 gold and +1 culture for each trade route with a different civilization or city-state. The trade route owners receive +2 gold for each trade route sent to Morocco. When Mega Bears Fan describes Morocco being geared towards being an economic civ, I would say that that is a fair assessment. I can't help but jump ahead right away to talking about what do you do if you're playing against Morocco, particularly early on in the game, where trade route owners receive +2 gold from each trade route sent to Morocco. So if you send, let's say 2, for example, so you get animal husbandry and you get sailing, you get an additional trade route from each one of those, you get +2 gold. If Morocco decides to send you 2 trade routes, yay for them. They get +3 gold and +1 culture for that first trade route with you, but not with the second one. So to me, right away, if you're near Morocco, buddy up to them as best as possible. I mean, they don't have to be your BFFs, but just enough that you're not in a state of war and that you are able to send a trade route to them. Obviously, as we've said before on the show, what is more lucrative about trade routes is if they are on the ocean. Just be sure to protect them. The other uniques, and of course, I think we'll get into the other uniques even more as compared to the unique ability, is the Caspah. Caspah requires the chivalry technology and gives us +1 food, +1 production, and +1 gold. A 50% defensive bonus to units, and oh yes, it must be built on the desert. And assuming you don't disable start bias, Morocco will start on the desert because that is their, in fact, start bias. They also have the unique unit, which is the Berber Cavalry. It is at the Military Science Technology, acquiring a horse, of course. Gets the standard cavalry bonuses, so no defensive terrain bonus, can move after attacking, the attack penalty against cities, but starts with the Desert Warrior promotion, which is a 50% combat bonus when fighting in the desert, and the Homeland Guardian promotion, which grants a 25% combat bonus when fighting in your territory. So in addition to protecting trade routes and establishing trade routes, I would say earlier in the game, you know, this is not to say that Morocco can't be a warlike civilization, but earlier on in the game, you want to take advantage, as far as I'm concerned, and Mega Bears Fan gets into this, to, again, be friends with them as much as possible, because earlier in the game, that +3 gold and +1 culture for each trade route or a different city-state is going to go farther than it will later in the game when, well, I'll just go with this other civilization and send multiple trade routes to them, and I'm going to get X amount of gold per turn more otherwise. Particularly when the Berber cavalry comes around, then you can be using that to go on the offensive, especially if your opponent is also in the desert, and certainly keeping the Berber cavalry at home, as it were, to help pick off some units that might be invading your territory, because if they're at full strength, then you get to a combat that's almost the equivalent of a landship, which is very, very powerful. So, in short, to me, Morocco, you're turtling a little bit early on. You're making nice, and the gold at this point can allow you to pretty well explore any type of victory condition you want. But whatever the victory condition is, don't negate the fact that the gold is only going to be able to take you so far, and you need to be making use of it earlier rather than later.
Yeah, I mean, on the trade route thing, strategy related to that is to get people to send you trade routes from the other civs, as many as possible, and then you send your trade routes to city-states, so that maximizes the amount of early culture you get without giving away too much. Because that's kind of the benefit of the +2 gold there, is that you can get people to send you trade routes, so that you can get the extra gold and culture from those while you send them to city-states, and then no one benefits from it, but since each city-state is individual, every city-state you send it to, especially if there's a mission attached to sending one, will get you the extra culture and gold in the early game. And that's kind of the more important thing, because, you know, extra culture in the very early game means that you're going to plow through your social policies faster. And if you're going for city tradition style, or, you know, even just expansion or whatever, extra culture is good for finishing off that first social policy tree. It definitely drops off benefit-wise as the game goes on, because inevitably +1 culture from trade routes, and eventually you get like +7 or +8 depending on what you got, isn't very much. It doesn't scale very well through the game for a unique ability.
At the same time, however, when you get to the point where you can get the chivalry and get the Casbah, and then you get to military science and get the Berber cavalry, to me it's at the point where the unique ability starts to fade is when the unique building and the unique units start to come into play. Like early game, focusing on the unique ability, then you get into the middle of the game. Now you're talking Casbah and Berber cavalry. Aaron90495 asks in the chat, do you think the Casbah should get improved with the technology? I know it gives gold, but late in the game, it's really mediocre, and it comes mid-game, so it doesn't get used much. I'm going to say no to that. I think that the Casbah, while not as versatile as some other unique improvement, it's not like, you know, the Dutch Polder, but I think that because it comes in the mid-game, it's kind of one of those things where, what have you done to this point to try to help yourself in terms of making the Casbah a little better? And Mega Bears Fan goes into a little bit of that. He describes it as that religion is not necessary for effective play with Morocco, but is strongly recommended. Hello, Desert Folklore, as an example, or Backup Choice talks about Goddess of Festival, since Incent often appears in clusters in desert.
If you're not in the desert, Morocco's pretty thin. You have your unique ability, but then that's about it.
Yeah. Because you look at the Casbah, and it's like, well, okay, no desert, uh-oh. And then even the unique unit, well, hey, we still get +25% combat bonus when fighting in your territory. Yeah, well, that's something, but getting rid of half of its strength, and then you're doing absolutely nothing with the unique improvement. Now, maybe you start off and you don't actually settle in desert for some reason. I didn't expect that your disable start bias is off. Or maybe you have very little desert. Then look for desert to expand to. Get there first, because if you can get there first and you can entrench yourself and then you can push through the technology and then get to Berber cavalry in particular, then you can, for example, sit them on your Casbahs to protect the Casbahs from being pillaged, and but also more importantly to be able to pick off a unit, move in, attack, withdraw, or stay in position for the counterattack if it hasn't been particularly injured.
Casbah is just a nice tile improvement if you want to turtle and you don't want to build a fort, and you're in the desert.
Yes.
So you can still work the tile, but
Yeah, the Kasbah's a funny improvement because, I mean, you don't usually want to be working desert, so then you're looking for hills or floodplains or something to build it on.
Yeah, that is an important point. Ooh, look at all this desert. I'll just settle here because there's lots and lots of desert. Well, you got to be able to have some food tiles to be able to get your population up to work the desert tiles. And you also need this thing called production, too. I mean, someone could say, oh, but all this gold you're getting, you can just buy. Yeah, well, that particularly starts to thin out as the as the game progresses. Yeah. And
you can't buy population.
And you can't buy population. Mega Bears fan talks about, you know, free trade leads the way to victory. Commerce seems like an obvious policy tree to open. It is. Well, yes. Fair enough. He says, but don't overlook patronage. As you gain more trade routes, you will likely run out of unique civs to send your trade routes to, and so you want to send them to city-states instead, quote-unquote, which ties into what Majin was saying earlier, because if you send stuff to city-states, they're not taking the science that you would be giving the other civs that could then turn around to push ahead of you or giving them gold. It's not like a city-state is going to turn around and declare war on you in and of itself, of course, only if it allied with somebody else that you were at war with. He also talks about the Merchant Confederacy. That would give you plus one gold for trade routes with city-states. Policy and patronage will buff the gold value of your city-state trade routes. And other policies in that tree will help improve relations and further science benefits and great people. So you want to be looking to see, hopefully, that you can settle increasingly towards city-states. And if you're also getting that gold early on, bank that, start making your friends, then your allies. Just make certain that if and when you find yourself in a war, that you are able to not only protect your land, but to a degree you can also help protect the city-state to keep those trade routes going, and then to also keep the advantages that they are giving you, whatever type of city-state it is. You get into the World Congress and the United Nations. You know, you want to do what you can to block, say, hey, no more trade with city-states, embargo them. Well, if you've allied yourself with enough city-states and you push yourself through technology tree and you get to whatever era, you now get plus one votes from city-state and then eventually plus two, then you can block that embargoing from happening. Mega Bears fan also talks about, in terms of wonders mentioned, Petra, Colossus, Big Ben, and Forbidden Palace, and John Seed Nunn, I wouldn't say took Mega Bears fan to task, but just kind of pressed the point that, you know, this assumed that you're playing on a low enough level where you can actually beat the AI to early world wonders. And, I mean, this is a guide. This isn't a you will do this and you will do that. I think it was good that Mega Bears fan that he did note that he added that he's typically playing on king level. When you're talking about world wonders, and if someone else gets them and then you can't get them, that's very, very specific. So anytime he talks about world wonders, they would benefit with. Not that you should. Like, for example, if you don't get Petra, should you rage quit playing Morocco? That in and of itself? No.
Keep in mind, the ones he is specifically talking about, the ones that he says should put high priority on, they're all based on either location or policy trees. And the AIs don't necessarily have them. Like, you can only build the Petra if you're in the desert. And if the AI does not have a desert, they can't build the Petra.
Yeah, if they don't adopt commerce, then they can't build Big Ben.
Right, and the AI tends not to do a lot of commerce. So Big Ben's usually one of those really easy ones. Plus, Big Ben requires you go up to industrialization, et cetera, which means that the AI is always lagging on that. The Colossus on water maps will go very quickly, but on land maps, not necessarily as quick. I mean, it is at Ironworking, but if it's not a water map, specifically a water map, then the AI doesn't necessarily aim to get those coastal cities as quickly as possible. So you might have an opening to get into the Colossus early. And same for Forbidden Palace. If you just happen to luck into a setup where there's no city-state focused civs on the map, then Forbidden Palace is fairly easy to get.
Yes, and it also ties into Mega Bears fan elsewhere in the guide talking about not overlooking patronage. And we've talked before on this show, it's not just, hey, you should open patronage so you can build the Forbidden Palace and then just be done with patronage. No, there's actually more advantage to going further down the patronage path, but once you are down the patronage path, then you can start looking at Forbidden Palace. And really, when you go down the list, Petra, Colossus, Big Ben, Forbidden Palace, I would say the list starts off with AI very likely to build, continually going down to AI not so likely to build.
Well, I'd say Forbidden Palace is more likely to get built by the AI than Big Ben.
Yeah, I rarely get Forbidden Palace on Immortal.
Yeah, you have to really focus for going to banking, and banking's right in the middle of the tech path for some of the AIs. So, and especially if they go to open patronage, they will quite happily go up to banking.
The AI, for me, tends to not adopt patronage very often. Yes, they adopt it more often than commerce, but it's so few and far between that it's almost ridiculous. But speaking of wonders, there's this national wonder called the East India Company. It's available at guilds, trade routes other players make with the city, but this will generate an additional 4 gold for the city owner, and the trade route owner gains an additional 2 gold for the trade route. Yeah, that's a good idea. In terms of world wonders, he doesn't put it as a priority, but he talks about, you know, his yummy castle and the Great Wall and the Red Fort to combine with the defensive bonuses in the desert with regards to the Berber cavalry and even Neuschwanstein. If you settled near a mountain and have castles in all of your cities, and especially if you've developed a wide empire, I usually have a wide empire in my game, and actually the ability to construct Neuschwanstein makes me construct castles. I don't necessarily often construct castles unless I've also gone down autocracy, which gives us happiness.
Yeah, autocracy, happiness. Mega Bear Fan also put up the Portuguese strategy guide, otherwise known as the Not So Mad Burroughs Luxuries in the Name of Portugal. So, of course, Portugal has their unique ability of gaining resource diversity grants, twice as much gold for Portugal in trade routes. Effectively, what that means is that in each trade route, the more diverse the items around a city are, the better your trade routes will be. So you need to hunt and poke around, make sure that you find a city outside of your, obviously, take your main trade city with lots of resources around it, which is a slightly different thing because your main trade city is usually your capital, but if you don't have a variety of resources and stuff like that, outside of course, the food ones, around your capital, then you might want to actually choose to make your main trading city and therefore the place you put the East India Company somewhere else. And then go hunting for AI cities that actually have great resource diversity. Because you do get quite a bit of cash out of this thing if you do it right. And it always happens based on even, you know, going in and out for the trade routes. So lots of extra gold to be had with Maria. But, of course, she also has one unique unit and one unique tile improvement. The now. Can we have it now? Which is a Caravelle replacement coming out of astronomy. It's basically, it's faster than the Caravelle, and it gets a bonus that you will use sometimes, but not really build a full strategy around. It has a promotion that allows you to sell exotic goods when adjacent to a foreign, i.e. civ or city-state, tile that'll give you gold and experience based on how far you are away from your capital. So this is really, really nice on huge maps, but on smaller maps, not so much. I mean, you do get some amount of money out of it, but unless you have a super high production city on a coast that can kick one of these things out per turn, and then you can get to the other side of the map really, really quickly. In this case, it is beneficial to find a way to stack up on all the plus movement bonuses in the game for Portugal to get them as far away as possible, basically to find a new way to generate cash for you. And then, of course, once you get there, if it is a city-state, just hand the now to the city-state, and you don't have to pay for it.
Yeah, because you can only use the exotic goods once. It's not like you can rinse and repeat with that same unit.
So, yeah, if there's a city-state that an AI is likely to attack or is allied against somebody, then handing them a bunch of nows is actually really funny because city-states, as much as they don't really do too much with their land units unless some magic occurs, when it comes to their caravels, they will go all over the map with these things, and they will troll trade routes. So if you want to be really mean to everybody, you can mass pump out nows and just start handing them off to city-states after you use the promotion to get some cash. Obviously, in that case, the experience doesn't really matter because you're getting rid of it. And you can get some decent cash, but you're not going to get into a situation where you can buy nows and then make more money off it. Unless, of course, you go full commerce plus Big Ben plus autocracy. But by that point, you've probably gone well past the caravel tech anyways. So you're going to not really get too much out of it.
Yeah, it's not like the now is going to give you the equivalent of, hey, so is this like being Spain and finding a natural wonder? No.
But you do get some good stuff out of it. And if you are playing a continents map or some place where there is, you know, water in between you and the other civs on the other continents, then nows are pretty decent with Maria for getting out there and meeting everybody slightly quicker than everybody else. All things considered, if you have a faster unit, you can get over there sooner, find where the good trade routes are quicker if you meet somebody, and then go hunt around their coastlines and then send all your trade routes over there very, very quickly because, hey, you want trade routes. Especially if it comes to other city-states. So if you're playing on one of the plus maps where all the city-states are off in the middle of the water and you need astronomy to go see them, then this could be a good way to get there quickly and collect all that cash for meeting them first. Of course, there is the Faetoria, which is their unique tile improvement. It is a factory of sorts. A Faetoria can only be built in city-state borders, and that's kind of amusing because the Faetoria just hands you a copy of each luxury that each of them
has connected.
Yeah, yeah. So basically, if you go to a mercantile city-state, this is the ultimate obvious because you get a copy of their luxury resource that just happens to randomly spawn, plus you also get a copy of their unique luxury resource, so the porcelain or the jewelry, in which case, yay, don't need to make friends with them to get their stuff. Of course, you do not get copies to sell, so it just counts for the fact that you have one. So there's no point in building Faetorias in multiple city-states that have the exact same luxury resource. In some cases, you say you only have one die, and it's on your border with that neighbor who's likely to declare war on you, then it might be worth dropping a Faetoria in a city-state that has die just because they might pillage your die in a war, or use a great general to citadel the die away from you. And at least in that particular case, you will have a backup copy. It also prevents you from accidentally selling your backup copies if you're paying too much attention or if multiple civs come to you to trade on the same turn and you can't see whether or not you have the extra copy or not. And that is one benefit to it. If you do have a die yourself and there's a city state with die, you can willingly sell your last copy of your die for money or whatever else and know that you still have a backup copy. It does come with plus 50 defense, but I don't know really why. It's basically a fort that you build in the city-state territory, which I guess helps them a little bit, but there's not really any benefit to it.
I guess the only benefit could be if that is your one copy of that particular resource. If the city-state was close enough to you, then you could move one of your units into that tile to then help protect it, and then it's giving you the luxury, and then you're also getting the plus 50% defense bonus, assuming, by the way, that you put a unit in there that can actually get a defensive bonus. But
yeah,
that kind of goes without saying.
Well, yeah.
Not just any unit will do for that.
Yeah, and I guess to keep in mind, you do need to build your Faetoria on the coast, and it can't be built on a spot that has a visible resource. And by visible resource, we mean, obviously, those strategics that will pop up over time. So if you know that it's potential that the city-state has coal in a spot or uranium or something, and you build your Faetoria there, they can't wander over and get rid of your Faetoria. So if they aren't your friend, they're allied to, say, Greece, it is plausible that you could spam out your Faetorias to prevent Greece from using the strategic resources in that city-state if you've managed to spam these on top of them. Because once they get revealed, they'll be revealed, but the Faetoria will still be there, and it can't be removed by another civ, and only you can actually remove the Faetoria. Though once it's in a city-state territory, I'm not sure that you can actually remove it anyways. Otherwise, he does get into strategies around Portugal in general. Obviously, trading is very important, and he talks about turtling, where Morocco is more turtling on land. Portugal, he focuses more on turtling in the ocean trade. So, of course, keeping your nows around does help keep those pirates away from your trade routes. You definitely don't want those pirates running around stealing all your sea trade routes and making a mess of your life. Of course, you know, Great Lighthouse is nice if you happen to get there. But if you're on a water map at a higher difficulty level, the Great Lighthouse is gone before you can even get to optics. otherwise, as you're getting up to the Renaissance, it does suggest starting to get extra workers going, and I fully agree with that. Don't worry about the whole Liberty Pyramid thing. If you're doing tradition, it doesn't really matter. You can do the same thing. Once you get close to the ability to build your Faetoria, you really want a fleet of workers out in the ocean running around to city-states and getting them built, primarily because you cannot remove city-state improvements. So if they've already built a farm or a fort, mine or something along that line, you can't remove it. So it has to be built on a hex that is nice and clean, which means you may actually want to pre-move some workers there to prevent the city-states from cleaning up their entire area. Because if you have no place to put it, you can't get anything out of it. And that becomes worse and worse as the game goes on, because the city-state AIs will be building more and more units, and that just makes it harder for you to actually, you know, get into a hex of theirs just because of all the units that they'll have.
So fun, though, watching them shuffle back and forth.
Oh, yeah. It can be.
Mega Bears fan does note that, unlike Morocco, Portugal's unique ability does not benefit other players directly. You do not gain an additional gold from trading with Portugal, but it also doesn't have an effect on the amount of gold that Portugal will receive from your trade routes, so there's no real reason not to trade with her. Well, the real reason not to trade with her is if you obviously want to go squish, but...
Yeah, more of a, do I really want to give her more money?
And potentially science.
Yeah.
It all comes back to science. Science is king. Dun, 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 dun.
Otherwise, definitely explore the world as quickly as possible so you can see where all of the awesome trade routes are. And don't worry, the game already pre-calculates all the extra little bonuses, so all you have to do is look at that nice happy number, see which one gives you the most, and go for that. Otherwise, yeah, get out there, get all of the city-state-based happiness that you can, keeping in mind if there is a city-state close to an AI and you can somehow create a city-state empire, you still get a copy of all the stuff that they pick up as they go. That could be funny, especially since certain cities can't be burned down, so city-states keep them.
Oh, yeah, and that could tie into, you know, gifting them nows.
Mm-hmm. Gifting them tons of nows so that they slam them into the walls. I mean, nows aren't really meant for fighting.
No, but...
Neither are caravels, but...
Thinking more of using them just for fodder, plus a little bit of influence you get with them.
And trolling and blockading and all the other stuff.
Yeah.
That city-states love to do. Just be aware of people like Venice and Austria, of course, that can just buy up those city-states, and there goes your benefit. And, of course, he talks about commerce with protectionism, granting two extra happiness for each luxury that you have access to. So if you've managed to roll a map where there's not exactly one luxury resource that every single city-state has, and they actually have a variety, you can get a lot of happiness out of that, especially from the jewelry and porcelain, because you can't normally get that unless you ally up those mercantiles. And since mercantiles are the ones that AIs will definitely want to go after more often, if you don't have a huge income to keep them going, or if you didn't go patronage, then at least getting their happiness is worthwhile.
And then that additional happiness can allow you to grow. Either, you know, your city is getting taller and or your empire getting wider, and then you push towards more golden ages. And hey, look at that. You get more production and more culture, plus 20% for each empire-wide. And hey, you also get this thing called more gold, which all ties back into Portugal also, as we've been getting at, a gold... what is the word? Inclined. There we go. That's what I'm going to go with, gold inclined.
For the most part, I mean, capturing Portugal is basically just shut off the trade routes, burn down the Faetoras, and you're good to go.
Yeah.
Or if you're Austria and Venice, just eat up all the city-states and then get rid of the Faetoras.
Yeah, I don't think the AI is particularly good at utilizing those trades.
I think they're okay with it. They're just not great with abusing it to the fullest extent.
They don't spend their money as well.
Portugal's got subtle bonuses, but nothing too overt that it's hard to shut down. But then again, these are all nice and subtle, so completely shutting down the unique ability and the units and the tile improvement takes probably more effort than it's worth, unless you're actually at war, and then, of course, taking out all the trade routes is very useful, which is probably a nice little benefit on the AI side anyways, versus somebody like Greece or Morocco or somebody else where it's like, okay, we should shut down the city-states. And then, hey, look, now you hurt.
We have a thread on Reddit started by Crappy Roads. statistics could include a hexagon tessellated sphere. Here's how. Man, that sounds complicated. But reading through it, it's not so much. A Goldberg polyhedron is a convex polyhedron that is made up of hexagons and pentagons. It can be made up of an arbitrary number of hexagons, but must contain exactly 12 pentagons. That number is dwarfed by the number of hexes. And so 5, even the dual map has 1,000 hexes, and thus would only be 1% pentagons using the Goldberg polyhedron. He goes on to suggest tiles that are virtually useless or impassable to be used for the pentagons. My only thought here is, within the current game model, what's the upside? But I don't see much downside to using it either. Like, if you're trying to model a true 3D world instead of the sort of donut-like things we get, or, you know, flat, flash spherical, like, tubular-type worlds we have going on here, like, if you're trying to model that, then it could make some sense to use it, perhaps. I don't see anything wrong with it.
For the time and energy to put into that.
Yes.
So long as it would say, hey, in addition to being more like a sphere, like, what is the gameplay implication going to be? Like, what is the advantage other than saying, look, we did this because we could and it looks neat and shiny and cool. And what does it do for gameplay?
That's been the impetus of a lot of changes in game design over time, though. So That's probably the largest actual bottleneck to using something like this is just how hard it would it be for developers to do it from a time and cost standpoint. Because from a gameplay standpoint, at least if you think about it in the current framework, it wouldn't make much difference, honestly. I mean, yeah, there'd be a couple tiles where you'd be nuking, like, a different number of adjacent provinces, but in practice, it would not make very much difference on gameplay whatsoever. So it would be more of an aesthetic thing, or, you know, you just get that global field going on.
And to me, aesthetic is nice, but I would actually want to be able to tie it to something more gameplay specific. Like, why would we in fact do this? What would be the advantage for gameplay, or at least what could be a advantage? Doesn't mean that it would automatically be an advantage.
Well,
I wouldn't just want it to be eye candy, that's all.
If you model a spherical world, perhaps you could go, like, across the poles or something. It doesn't have much as actual historical basis, but you could do it from a strategy sense on certain kinds of worlds.
You could launch nukes across.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
North versus side to side. I mean, the real point of it is that the world is a sphere, therefore in-game should also be one to better
and
model.
People just really miss the globe view from Civ 4.
But even Civ 4 was just a side-scroller, whatever. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it means that if you're going, like, over the pole stuff with, like, nukes or even just flying, it makes more direct sense for distance calculations rather than, I need to go sideways and then, hey, look, I've magically wrapped around the world and came back to where I was by going sideways. Why couldn't we go up?
It would probably help the distance calculations in general, which have been historically wonky in the Civ series as a result of the limitations of the flat maps.
But I would suggest only expect that if Civ is 64-bit system only and has a decent graphics requirement.
Well, I mean, how early do you think Civ 6 is coming out? If we're talking like a couple of years still, then that's realistic. It could work out very well as long as it's not too costly in development.
So we had 3 years to development just for the sake of spheres.
not so much, Ben.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was getting at. In part.
But it may or may not be, depending on how they're doing their engine and everything. You never know.
One little thing with the Goldberg polyhedron is that you can't actually send a unit in a straight line. It's a little odd.
But I don't see how it would fully and completely make Civ better. I mean, yes, there's the going over the top, and it's a world, blah, 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 but basic gameplay in the end is still probably going to be about the same.
But shiny!
Ooh, we could just make it a true sphere, guys, and then have each unit have a distance capability. Yeah! That'll help the newbies.
By help, I'm hearing make them run away in droves?
We don't want that. We want new players.
Basically, this is graphics. Sure, if it's plausible, but I'd rather better gameplay.
I think it's fair enough to say that in time, it wouldn't be that prohibitive to do this, if it even is prohibitive now. I don't know. I'm not a programmer, but that's only like the first test. The real test we've been getting at is what is the benefit to gameplay? Because even if you say, oh, well, people working on gameplay, they aren't necessarily going to be working on making it look shiny and new. Yeah, well, you're spending time and resources that you're putting into that and putting it into, like imagine saying, like a better engine, a better gameplay, a better experience. Because just because it's more realistic doesn't mean it's necessarily better for the game.
Yes. Just because you have two developers, one works on the engine, one works on graphics, doesn't mean that you are not paying them both So, yes, you might have people just sitting around going, what are we supposed to work on? Because the people getting paid are the ones over on the other team. And then these people don't work there anymore. There's a little thing called money, and they only have so much money to put into a game. That's something people tend to forget when they go complaining about developers just standing around.
So hey, while we're talking about shiny things, maybe we can add global warming back. No? There's no groans of, I'm surprised.
And well, no, because global warming back doesn't necessarily mean it would be like we've had in previous Civ titles. If it was, let's get global warming back the way it was, no, then I would groan.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, that's not nice things to say.
All back over on Reddit again. Legomone, the idea that now that everybody was talking about the spear map thing.
Before you go on, Mackie, I think it's fair to say that we can consider this global warming even if we don't consider this alternate map implementation.
Just a bunch of hot air?
Yes.
If I set aside the fact that they're basing it off of the spear type that we just talked about, I actually am liking this topic more.
Yeah, if you throw out the whole basic concept that he starts with, yeah.
Well, his... Sure. It's not the premise.
Anyway, he does agree that the original Civ 4 version was kind of lame, which we know. But with a spherical map and more powerful computers, it would be cool to see the ecological effects of global warming, industrialization, and even nuclear war after the industrial age. In Civ, of course, not real life, he points out. Oh, some of the things. The ice caps could get smaller, and oceans would rise. Now, I see the oceans rising a little problematic because a lot of people are going to have coastal cities.
And he does point out later on, if your city happens to be on the coast, bye-bye city.
Yeah, I hope you didn't need that.
I have fundamental gripes with that. With this coaster.
Yeah, the coastal
and
thing,
I think that
no,
this kind of design is awful in strategy game. If you are making a game and you are calling it a strategy game, putting in a mechanic that you're virtually guaranteed to encounter without much control over it whatsoever that will completely ruin an equalized strategy is a bad design element. There's nothing good about that kind of stuff. Having your cities disappear because, at the end of the game, without really anything you can do to control it, is crap in strategy, especially if cities still carry the value they have throughout the Civ series. If they're, like, not valuable at all, then that's different, but then we're really getting away from what Civ has been to this point.
Okay, oceans rising. Oceans are always rising, or falling, and rising, and falling. Cities don't go away with it. Seriously, over the course of history, there's certain areas have seen issues, but yeah, they've dealt with it. And it's not like oceans rising multiple feet.
It's not like they were 10 feet over a year or something crazy like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, they can, but then we're probably all dead anyways by that point for other reasons.
I mean, there's definitely some potential, something you could do more minor that would be interesting.
Ice caps getting smaller and revealing a little bit more land or something like that, that's not a bad thing. There's another one in his list here about some of the tundra being replaced eventually.
Tundra and taiga doesn't really give way to grasslands and plains.
They technically already are grasslands and plains. They're just cold grasslands and plains kind of-ish. Taiga, at least, I think.
Tundra is just desert. That's really...
Now, we don't need the storms and hurricanes, though.
Well, I take that more as just have weather. So it would be like if there's a hurricane flowing through a certain area, then your planes wouldn't have the range. Movement would be a little harder. Combat would be less damaging.
It doesn't fit the model. It doesn't work. Unless you're changing the time scale, you can't model that. There are no 20-year hurricanes.
Well, obviously.
There's not even a hurricane that lasts a full year. It doesn't fit the scope of the game to model that with a direct in-game tactical effect.
I think something like that could work so long as there was, tying back to your point earlier, Phil, about choices and strategy games, so long as there was something, as soon as that's introduced in the game, that you could do either something to counteract it to some degree, or when it came across that you were given a choice, even if it was like a crappy and a crappier choice, so long as there was some kind of connection to what you did or didn't do up to that point in the game, and then when the event happened that you were presented with the opportunity to make another choice, depending upon the degree of these choices and effects, I'd be okay with it.
Yes, I agree with you there.
It kind of goes back to random events in Civ 4. And of course, we can't talk about this without talking about random events.
I agree with you there, but what it cannot become and what it often does in strategy games is a false choice, where your strategies that will either cause it or not cause it are consistently the same, in that your alternative is just so crappy that you would never pick it, even despite the penalties. And then it's the same thing with your event quote-unquote choice. If it's something where you can, once you're an experienced player, always just click a certain option without thinking about it, you have a bad design element.
Yeah.
Well, then that's gone the other way.
But that happens a lot with this kind of quote-unquote event or this kind of function in the game.
Yeah, now you're talking about both extremes, right? Either, oh, there's nothing I can do, or there's something I always can do, so therefore I'm not thinking about it.
Yeah. Neither of those.
But both have the exact same answer, though. If the player just goes bleep and doesn't even think, then it's not dreaded G.
Nope.
It's just in-game. Then again, I mean, there's a place for just purely in-game stuff that has just stuff happens, period. Even in strategy games. It's a time scale thing. I mean, if this was U4 that had per day thing, then yes, hurricanes should happen. Storms could happen.
Tactical control there is different, too.
Yeah.
It's a different game. It's a different design. You're not covering, like, human history in its entirety. You're covering a couple hundred years.
Yeah. But also, even just on the scale of things, I would be okay with migrating animals.
Yeah, that was one of the suggestions, that the animals and plants either disappearing or going to a different area.
Every resource disappeared.
But even migrating animals, I mean, I'd be okay with that in the concept of it, because if you have that, then you could also extend it to the point where you can move where the animals are. So if you want an area to be farm rich with lots of cows, and maybe there's horses off in the far distance and you want to go get them so you can produce horse units, and then you have the migration and or be able to move them, then that could be a better mechanic.
Yeah, because it probably surprises people that cows are not native to Texas.
If they move and now they're in another source, if that happened to be a tile, for example, in your city, then you could get a dialogue prompt to say, hey, there are now cows on this particular tile. Do you want to move the nearest worker there to go then improve it for a pasture? So you've been notified that, A, this has actually happened, and B, give the player a choice to actually start using that or not using that. And they could decide, you know, at this point, no, I don't want my worker to dispatch doing that. It's currently constructing a mine on this frickin' aluminum I just found. I'll do it later.
Can you imagine the posts about this where, like, they tend up their animals and are breeding them and are, like, taking care of them, and they just uncontrollably move thousands of
No, the moment you put them in a pasture, they wouldn't migrate.
Okay. I mean,
all those resources that are outside of everybody's tile city range now could actually migrate into the city or be migrated into instead.
Yeah, that'd be more the point.
I will say, though, from this initial list of things that could happen in terms of the ecological effects, at the very end, deserts would expand. Yet earlier he said, you know, random tiles around the world turning into useless desert, which is kind of lame. So the desert's going to expand, and where is it going to expand to? Is it suddenly going to be desert in your ocean then, in which case it then didn't take away from a tile that you were... Like, I don't understand that.
Existing deserts have the adjacent hexades become deserts,
yes,
rather than, like, some random desert appearing in the middle of a tropical rainforest and then not expanding, just that you just have a random drop.
Sahara, and maybe the Sahara would get bigger.
Yeah. Which is happening in real life. Deserts get bigger as they slowly get bigger.
That's true, but is that fun gameplay-wise? Is that...
Who cares?
What do you mean, who cares?
If you're Marsha.
We already covered it. It depends how it's modeled.
If a desert adds one hex, you know, every 50 turns to it, that's early game, a really long time before that happens. Late game, well... then it happens a lot more often.
If that doesn't start triggering until after somebody hits industrialization, of course.
I'm pretty sure desertification happens.
Well, it happens without it, but yeah. Yeah.
And then there's also this little thing about changing the victory conditions a little, which, I raised a Spock eyebrow.
Well,
we could use it. It's no harm in that.
Maybe the science fiction could involve you researching ecotechs to stop global warming. Well, Alpha Centauri's tradition at this point. Although having more techs to help you against global warming in that later part of the tech tree would not be bad.
It's a fairly obvious point. You go from moon landing to Alpha Centauri with no step in between. yes, that's been part of the game forever, but other steps like going to Mars or something else along that line first might not be a bad thing to slow down the tech victory once you get to that point. Because I'm pretty sure we can't build a spaceship that goes to Alpha Centauri yet.
No, I know, but we also can't live for, you know, the 6,000 years that this game spans either. So,
hey, we're already in the info era, so game terms-wise, we're there. Of course, we don't have giant death robots yet.
Darn it.
I don't think we will, just from a practicality. But, you know.
That's a different argument.
The risk of this being, like, freaking off-topic cast, I can see our descendants in 1,000 years going, do you see how they used to refer to that as the information age?
Information shark age, maybe.
Maybe one final point on this. It actually came as a response in the thread on Reddit from Ermiger in Space. Part of the reason, yes, wanted to mention this quote was to be able to say it in that way. But anyway, he's like, ties into not just this topic, but the one before, which is part of our research lab, where we look at things that are not in Civ yet, but maybe in the future. Or in some cases, things that were in Civ in the past, and maybe they should be brought back in some way or not. I've not even seen Civ 6 officially announced yet, and we're already seeing a lot of suggestions from people who aren't developing the game to other people who aren't developing the game. Did I miss the big post where Firaxis decided to crowdsource development? Or are we all just wasting a lot of time and effort on ideas that will have literally no impact on the next game? If the game isn't in development, the discussion is irrelevant. If it is in development, they're not going to rewrite the game engine because of a Reddit post. Whoa, really?
Somebody got up on the wrong side of the coffee pot.
I can think of a few things in that statement that are actually wrong.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I don't know if it's actually serious. I've never seen this person before. I wouldn't say that I've looked to Reddit. It may be a complete troll post, but it is so well written. And actually, Lego Moan responded, which, if we are going to take it seriously, he pointed out that this is actually the Civ subreddit, not the Civ 5 subreddit.
That's right.
And besides, when you're talking about Civilization 5, I don't know how you cannot be talking about a Civilization 6. Just like if we were talking about Civilization 1, when people talked about Civilization 1, they would end up talking about Civ 2.
And you can never tell where the devs are lurking and reading.
Yeah, exactly. Recorded for episode 194 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian Team, Matt Jin, and Kane Morgan.
We got feedback.
We do have feedback.
John C. Nunn, on the combined pool reducing choices, it would only be because food sources are now plentiful. And I do quite agree with that, because the food cargo ship especially is fantastic. Even a food caravan could give you a huge boost at the start. Nick was very glad that you could answer his question. He was saying liberty with patronage might be stronger than tradition with patronages. Extra gold from 10 cities, 5 to 6 built and 4 to 5 puppets connected via trade routes. And a GE popped wonder for the extra gold, Manu Picchu, and selling copies of extra luxuries, subsidics. He's often had 16 to 22 CS allies, which seems quite a lot.
Yeah. Seems quite a lot.
I don't think I've regularly had many of those, to be fair. But I'm kind of a tradition guy, so liberty, I don't know, it seems a bit slower.
Well, I don't think we need to get into liberty versus tradition again.
No, we might skip that one.
And it was the next post that generated a fair bit of follow-up conversation.
From Casper GM?
Yes.
Yeah, he was very annoyed the handling of discussion of balance patch digestions. Very frustrated, he was saying. I don't know. Just a couple of examples. Separation of the great engineers, scientists, and merchants. I don't think you can separate them, can you? Because it's just going to be far too overpowered. You're going to be popping great people left, right, and center. And again, lancers. Well, whoever builds lancers.
Basically, when you have a change, that the change would require a fundamental rebalancing of a good amount of the other features in the game just to make it even possibly viable, then it's a bit questionable as a change. It's just for balance, per se.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think because you can buy great people with faith, then the way it is, I think, is just about perfect. If you couldn't buy them with faith, then perhaps there could be a case to be made, but...
Well, yeah. Regardless of that, like, you can't really do a complete mechanics overhaul in the guise of a balance change. It just doesn't work.
Well, I mean, you can, but the focus, especially between John Canons, because he mentions the same thing in his post as Casper, it's the idea that separating the great people into different counters, they get mad because they're talking about the great merchant in their responses. And it's not that separating the counters would make the great merchant any better, but they still have a complaint that the great merchant is worse than the engineer and the scientist. And my answer to that is fix the great merchant. Yeah. Don't break a mechanic that works just because you don't like the great merchant. Fix the great merchant to the point where it's equal, or nerf the great scientist and the great engineer. Basically, balance those three against each other so that they are all equally useful and viable, not break the mechanic just so that you can have more. Because if you just break the mechanic, you still have very powerful engineers, but you'll also get very powerful science. And you'll have both very powerful things. And you probably still won't make your stupid great merchant. So you're not fixing the problem by attacking the mechanic. You're basically still ignoring the problem, which was, as Bothone put out, the great merchant.
But you would also create a new problem and a very
problem. You'd throw the balance of the game out the window. And you killed the baby rather than throwing out the bathwater.
Yeah, but the great merchants do definitely need to have a buff because at the moment there's just no point in having them.
Yeah, but that's not the problem.
The problem is not the combined slider. The problem is the great merchant.
Although, to be fair, I'm pretty sure when we were talking about this, because I know Casper GGM didn't like how we said, oh, Imba, Obi. We did very specifically, especially on stuff like Honor and some of the other ones where we just kind of laughed for a while. We said, we understand that this is a very big problem. We understand going in that direction, like making a big change to make it more balanced, to make it better, is a good idea, but this particular one just isn't going to happen. It would, like, skew the game horribly and not actually fix anything.
Well, if you stop listening 20 minutes in, though, you might not capture it.
Because I'm pretty sure we actually said that.
If our voices are nice and soothing, and it makes you nod off to sleep.
This was the second of two parts of looking at the balance patch. And in episode 193, it was just over half an hour. And if you compare that to episode 192, where we looked at other components from this balance patch, if you combine those two over two episodes, we spent more than an hour talking about this particular thread. And I know Casper commented on episode 192, but didn't say that he didn't like what he was hearing with regards to that. So to the point of where he only listened through the first 20 minutes, yeah, he may very well have missed some of those points that he wouldn't have found quite so annoying. But I did want to ensure that we brought up this counterpoint on the show because we do realize that not everybody who listens to the show is going to agree with everything that we say. And Casper was not trolly in his response. He wasn't just saying, you guys are wrong because, you know, you're a bunch of so-and-sos. And we've had comments like that, and we don't give those criticism for criticism's sake to time of day. That's a waste of everybody's time. But this was constructive concern and also was looking for some further explanation of the positions. I admit in my response that I wasn't on this episode, so I would ask.
It wasn't me. It wasn't me. Although, to finish with his post, he talks about cover on siege, that comment, versus the plus 200% bonus on defense. And I think he and somebody else is actually quite correct, and we might have blatantly forgot about it, or at least mentally forgot about it. Cover works on combat strength, not on range strength, but catapults and other ranged units use their range strength versus cities when it's ranged versus ranged. Therefore, cover does not actually benefit ranged units when it comes to bombardment. That actually is a much more accurate statement, and therefore, yes, cover is kind of useless versus cities. Unless it actually gets fixed. And yeah, that should get fixed. So that it's both range strength.
Wow, that's a bit different from how I read the thread initially, though. Like, in terms of damage sources and when it's working versus not.
Yeah, it's just an issue for cover. If you assume it's melee units, it works.
Mobily.
But I would still refuse to see 200% bonus on defense for catapults. Because, seriously, you have no shields. That's just a bad joke in and of itself.
I don't know, it would give you a bit more opportunity to build catapults, though, because I can't remember the last time I built a catapult.
I build catapults all the time.
Really?
You know what composite bows are for?
Yeah.
I know we've talked about that this on the show, about composite bows and their versatility.
Ranged units versus mounted units. Kespergen mentions the whole desirability of rock, paper, scissors mechanic in game so that each unit has a counter. But I will counter your counter saying that cav units already counter ranged because ranged units use their combat strength, which is crap, versus cav units when cav units are the ones attacking. And that cav units don't get terrain defense, etc., when ranged units are attacking them. So, yeah. Cav do really good job at ripping apart ranged units when cav are attacking, so they don't need a bonus. And it actually puts it in there, just that people don't really use cav very much, and I say that's your fault for not using cav against ranged units. If you use cav, they will rip apart ranged units. The problem with it is that people just want to use standard infantry and other stuff like that. And I get it, because standard infantry is way better than cav, because they actually get defense. But you can't complain that it's not in there that cav gets a bonus versus ranged attack, because cav is strong enough to rip apart ranged units, so there's no point in giving them another bonus for it.
The fact that this episode and the last few in particular on Threads on CFC have spawned not only strategy discussion or just civ discussion in general in response to what we said, but then what someone has said in response, someone else has responded to it, so it's become an extension of that topic, is really nice to see, even when there's differing opinions. And that's how we end up getting better understandings of the game and a better game in general, because we know that the developers and the publishers, at least some of them, do listen to this show just like they follow what conversation is being said on Civ Fanatics, the Pult, and other Civ fan sites, and actually even those places like Reddit. What makes this even better is the person who started this thread not only realized that we talked about their conversation, because I think that happens a lot. Often the threads we talk about, whoever started the thread, if they find out that we talked about it, never say anything or next to never say anything. So this person who started the thread, Go Stu, who on YouTube goes by Stuart Conrad, apparently, because he initially responded there and then responded in even more detail on the CFC thread in the Civ 5 general discussion forum in response. No, we're not going to go through his detailed response. Time limitations really prohibit that. And he even acknowledged, I know that the pacing demands that you move on. Anyway, thanks for the review. There's no more divisive topic in any community than game balance. Well, I don't know. I mean, if you're not talking about a game, then game balance is not going to be an issue, let alone a divisive one. But I know exactly what you're saying. Now I'm trolling. People listen to the show. That in and of itself is like a win. And then people care about what we say to actually give us feedback. Another win. So we are truly blessed. Group hug for everyone. I'm really not sure that's the reaction I was looking for, but okay, well, you know, whatever.
Sorry, raised eyebrow just makes no sound.
Yeah.
I was doing the group hug in my head, Dan. It's okay.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Well, perhaps we will take it to a close then. Thank you for joining us on Polycast episode 195. This is the main team, and today I was joined by regular co-hosts Dan Q.
Is the audience joining us, or are we in fact joining them?
Makalua.
The only thing I'm joining right now is another cup of something caffeinated.
Majin.
Caffeine.
And guest co-host, Chazzy Cat.
All right, thanks everyone. It was fun.
Hey, Mackie, that actually was a
Oh, that was a segue? I'm sorry. I can't tell a segue between you two just, you know, going on and blah, 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 blah. And...
I think we just got insulted for our segue.
Yes, you did.
We weren't talking about it until Dan made us do it.
You know, now you're getting pedantic. You notice that you can't spell pedantic without Dan.
Nice.
Well, okay. On topic. Jeez.
No, that's not allowed.
One little thing you guys go off on this huge tangent about. What did we just say about pedantic and Dan? Gosh.
Record date March 15th, 2014. Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.